Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast. I'm your host, Karthik Nachip. We live in an age of big data. India, ostensibly, is at the heart of that era. The use of big data is by no means new. Different kinds of entities, states, firms, organizations, and even individuals use it for various purposes. Within the Indian state, data is being increasingly used to assist with policymaking, particularly in areas like agriculture that are integral to India's development. Private sector companies have also been keen to collect and leverage user data to improve their operations and business models. Whether or not data analytics or different kinds of data mining techniques are being used with a set of rules is a big question in India today, wrapped around the discussions in the Personal Data Protection Bill that could be passed very soon. But how did we get to this big data conjuncture in India? How did data become so powerful? What does data fetishization mean for India and how it's used? A terrific new edited volume, Lives of Data, Essays on Computational Cultures from India, offers a range of perspectives on how data lives in India, how past trends influenced current data discussions, how biases and designs influenced the power and value of data, and more importantly, how individuals and communities are affected by that. What is undeniable, and which comes through clearly in the volume, is that data is and will be a vital and useful lens to ask questions on Indian politics, the role of the state, and how the state deals with both capital and citizens going forward. Before we go into the conversation, I also want to just add that this is our first edited volume, and it's a great pleasure to speak to the editor who shepherded the 15 chapters in this splendid volume. Here is Sandeep Mertia, PhD candidate at New York University, on his recent edited volume, Lives of Data, published by the Institute of Network Cultures in late 2020. So I want to just ask first, how did this volume begin? You're in the middle of your PhD, which I assume is related to the book. So talk to us about how this project got going.
Hi, Karthik. Thank you for having me, and thank you for finding a common time for us on the opposite ends of the time zone. So this book is an outcome of Lives of Data project that I did at Sarai CSDS, Center for the Study of Developing Societies in Delhi, from 2014 to 2017. I'm an ICT engineer by training, information and communication technology, and I did my engineering at an institute called Dhirubhai Ambani Institute in Gandhinagar, where one was lucky to have a certain unique exposure to science and technology studies. And my focus in my undergrad developed towards research in digital infrastructures, rural internet access, ICTs for development, e-governance, and those they became the entry points for me into larger conversations about the technological transformation that we have seen in India in the last decade or so. So when I graduated, instead of going into the tech industry, I landed up at Sarai, and in January 2015, we started this project with the idea of opening up approaches and basically setting up vantage points to how to look at this new wave of research and discourse and technologies emerging around data. And the centrality of this new digital data object, that's something that connects everything from your smartphones to governments to businesses and makes everything efficient and makes nations and companies leapfrog into certain kind of futurity that was considered very distant for a place like India is now suddenly is beginning to feel temporarily much closer. So that was the key idea to how to open up a project into thinking about this discourse critically, with the awareness that we're sitting at CSDS. So the awareness of the histories of statistics and development, critical media histories, histories of how media circulation and infrastructures work in the subcontinent, in our extremely diverse kinds of media circuits, vernacular consumption circuits, and so on, and how data practices differ from the larger hype cycle discourse that we are seeing. And instead of just producing a critique of the hype cycle, how do we open up vantage points into understanding how this transformation is happening on the ground? That was the broad idea.
There was a question early on that you asked, I think, in the introduction, and I wanted to just ask you that now. How did data become so powerful in India in the first place?
Thank you. And we try to center that question in many ways in the lives of data work and in the process of assembling various chapters in the book. And there are various ways to look at it, but one of the key difference that we kind of have to grapple with is the state, that it is initially the colonial state that constitutes the census and fingerprinting and all kinds of identification technologies for shaping certain kind of subjectivity and governance practices. And then the book enters into the conversation around post-colonial nation states, models of statistical governance and data-driven decision-making, as you know today, its histories into something that was more centered around knowledge production rather than digital culture affinities that we know today data to have. So there's a tension there that something that was largely paper-based in terms of media and was largely centered around the state, right, is now happening and unfolding in many different ways and forms in different institutions. That knowledge production for governance, that aspect. The second aspect is something that is related more closely to media culture, that we are not going into the so-called digital age after having let's just put it this way, we are not accessing the internet of the mythic 90s or the early 2000s. Vast majority of India is getting on the internet of WhatsApp, of Facebook, of YouTube, of TikTok, which is now banned, and other vernacular apps, an internet that is largely designed and imagined around the smartphone, right? So that digital culture that defines our contemporary and the history of colonial and post-colonial governance that shape the knowledge production and governance practices around data, those are the two important, entry points for us to problematize this homogeneous global discourse of data just emerging as a natural product of technology or something.
So let's just historicize data a bit. There's a tendency, at least to me, to pin a lot of what's happening now in India on data to Aadhaar, right? And its development on various digital interfaces. But can you take us back a bit further? What happened from the 50s to the 80s and how those computing histories led to this particular moment?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And so much of those histories are waiting to be written, actually. So while there have been multiple publications on Prasanto Chandra Malanovis, someone who I also cover in my chapter in the book, nobody had paid attention before this to the fact that the first employee of Indian Statistical Institute in the 1930s was a human computer, right? This is in the 30s. So when Mahalanobis gets the institutional resources of the Nehruvian state to build and really run, he was also the chairman of the planning commission, the second planning commission, to have the full access of the resources of the state to create, put these practices in place in low resource conditions, in conditions where carrying out these surveys has a high cost, and you have language limitations. Every few miles, the language changes. So standardization, that is something that is central in the history of statistics and data. Standardization is a very particular kind of challenge. So the state as a sort of regulator or sort of setting the bar of where how these practices are supposed to play out is key. And historians of science have shaped our understanding a lot in this. If you look at Janvi Falke's work or even some of Itti's work, that how science and knowledge production was happening, that gives us some cue into what was going on 50s, 60s onwards. But other than that, there are very little histories of data per se. There are histories of planning. And there's, of course, historian Nikhil Menon's work on history of economic planning. But if we look at those long decades before something called the digital is beginning to emerge, We have yet to cover a lot of ground on how paper-based media and governance practices shaped the data imaginaries of that time, because it is going from the planning commission to urban development to agriculture to space programs and so on. So various things, various kinds of literacies are being linked to data production in those times, right? And while they are up, take a certain kind of different durable form with digital media, to really know we have to do this crisscross between paper and digital, and those histories are yet to be written.
I want to get to that crisscrossing later on, but before that, a key argument in the volume is that data derives its value from its relational nature, right? The lineages, affinities, networks, and relations that actually give data value within specific contexts like India. And it's how this relational aspect is cultivated through devices, softwares, but also other computational methods and techniques that actually empower data, right? And the experience of Aadhaar and how it has facilitated these various state-run digital infrastructures that run on data comes to mind here, right? So the state, as you mentioned, is kind of keen to use data to assert and accomplish various sovereign objectives, right? So how do scholars now then begin to entangle this complex landscape? I mean, in your other words, the cultural ontologies of data?
Yeah, that's a great question. And relationalities is, of course, not just something that is of importance to historians and social scientists and even STS scholars. Data practitioners are acutely and intimately involved in the process of mapping relationalities and data ontologies. The very term for the most used database design in the world, relational database management system, right? So the moment computing is entering into these spaces, and this could be difficult to map in a short while, but if we look at just the history of databases from 60s, 17 onwards, what IBM was doing, how different competing database models were being imagined, and which model took the dominant form 1970s onwards in IBM machines, that gives us some critical perspective into how few years or decades down the line that model got imbricated with certain practices of doing data that were happening before these database technologies entered that zone, right? So technologies of writing and statecraft on the one hand, and then 1970s, 80s onwards, when computer storage, right? Computer storage, and then later with the internet, computer-based communication enters the picture. Relationalities expand and transform, and older ones are displaced and are remediated, right? And there it is that that process of mapping also takes a different kind of challenge, because the materiality is changing so quickly that the stable designation of the data object is a pure fantasy. And this is one of the key deceits of big data discourse, that it tries to signify and project a stable unitary data object around which all the revolution can happen. But if you look closely, there are the mirrored practices and different kinds of materialities overlapping around this large category of the digital. But if we look inside, within the digital, so many materialities coalescing and diverging that you can only think of them, you can only make them legible in a relational sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what does it then mean to protect data? Is that even possible?
Pardon?
What does it mean then to protect data in this context? Is that even possible?
So that question, I believe, is emerging from concerns around user privacy and then harms and risks and exposures to certain predatory practices that have become dominant now, right? While the distinction between public and private has a long history, the way these practices have taken shape, and most of them are traced back to Silicon Valley and in most of the world, in fact, are taking roots without definite protections in the law or even in the practices of the state itself, where the state is one of the key perpetrators of violations of privacy and surveillance. So I while that question has immense practical value and urgency to it, I would urge us, like scholars, to unpack how the subjectivity of the user is being imagined here. What kind of user is being imagined to have a certain kind of privacy? So much of it is imagined around social media, right? That one user, one profile, that interface where you as a rational individual engage with others, and suddenly all that rationality is up in the air with incomprehensible amount of misinformation and disinformation, right? So privacy cannot be separated from these debates. It's flowing alongside these formations, and many of times the internet access still happens outside of the private space. If you go into rural areas, a bunch of rural fieldwork projects that I did from 2011 to 16, 17 onwards, there are still kiosks, so there are still people sharing smartphones. If you look at household ownership figures, more like roughly just about 40% of households have smartphone access, right? So a privacy, absolutely important to protect, but also at the same time, to critically investigate what do we mean by privacy when just about half of this country or even half global population is online, and what kind of leeway companies that are trying to speculate about the next billion and so on, what kind of future are they imagining? How is privacy inscribed or left out of those futures?
So when you were talking about relationalities and how difficult it is to sort of map them and come to grips with them. And I kept thinking about then what's the role of law in this context, right? And how do we, at least from a regulatory point of view, begin to think about coming up with a set of rules that can effectively make sense of what's happening in this data context, right?
Absolutely. And there's another project at Sarai that took place called The Act of Media. And there's a forthcoming volume from it. My friend Siddharth Narayan, who's just based in Australia, he ran it. And there also, you'll see that so much of the legal discourse about the unprecedentedness of the contemporary is actually made legible, because law as a structure is something that is epistemologically taxonomic. It works through precedents and codes and so on. So while it invokes moments of the anxieties around the video era or cassette circulation and so on, there is the wider cultural shift has to be put in contact with the legal possibilities if we have to make meaningful possibilities. This is as far as I can contribute as a non-lawyer in the conversation, because otherwise you're just left with a table of comparison that US law this, Europe law this, and India this, and the wider context in which what that media consumption or culture means in context is sort of discounted.
So there are a few chapters on technology practitioners in the volume, mm-hmm. And you cover them as either, I think you call them data practitioners. Is being a technology entrepreneur or a data practitioner fundamentally different in the Indian context now? If I remember, I think Itti Abraham had an article in 2017 where he talked about how India is now moving away from technology czars, right? And he sees what he calls as these new missions, which are emerging, that further different kinds of biopolitical projects, right? And the sense that I get is that you see these entrepreneurs now, they straddle the divide between government and the tech sector much more openly and collaboratively than in other countries. And there's a crossing of ideas and mindsets, I think, from one realm to another, but also that hubris, which I guess also travels, right? I'm kind of worried about the implications of these new entrepreneurs, data practitioners, and the power they have in India now. And I'm thinking about, you know, for example, iSpirit, right? Which is, I mean, I don't know how you would characterize them, as a roundtable, as a think tank, as a network of volunteers, but they have immense power, and they are, you know, using it to advance a certain you know, neoliberal agenda that coheres with what the state wants to do, right? So yeah, how do you make sense of that?
iStart is a particular beast of an organization, and while it iStart in itself has taken an organizational form, many of those practices that do not label themselves as an organization or as having a front of people with faces and so on, those practices of collaboration between the state and different kinds of tech entrepreneurs, I'm 100% with you that they have opened many new kinds of challenges for thinking about power, political economy, and accountability. Till date, no one knows who really made Arogya Setu. Volunteers. But at the same time, what this book tries to do in bringing data practitioners and entrepreneurs into the conversation is to map the zone of socio-technical possibility. Because a lot of what these entrepreneurs and collaborators of the state try to do is to create, promote certain kinds of inevitable technological futures. Let me put it that way. But if we read through essays by Lily Irani, who's pioneered the concept of entrepreneurial citizenship, and practitioners like Prerna Mukharia, Gunneet, Nurula, Gaurav Gudwani, you see that different kinds of practices are possible. that different models of data practices and entrepreneurship are possible. And that is key for me.
So a lot of what's being done now is at least on the data side from the government is happening under this kind of development narrative, right? Is that in a way being used to, I guess, advance this biopolitical project that the government is keen on addressing? Mm-hmm. How do you see development intersecting with these new technologies and these new forms of data governance and various methods to assist the government in what it wants to achieve?
Right. So there are, so that's a great question and it's immensely important one. One way to break it down is to understand that in the older world of development studies, the state was somewhat the primary place where sovereignty resided, right? After globalization and after this proliferation of digital networks, that sovereignty is a much more suspicious category. And it's different, it's located in many different places, the way it moves around, how its assemblages are made and unmade. So a lot of what the state does and what people interested in working with the state for national interest or development do kind of is a staging of sovereignty after the fact that the state is no longer the absolute sovereign over its own economy, which is globalized, over digital networks, which it tries to just pull the plug on. We are the world leader in that. But here's a critical economic ceiling that many technology companies have hit, not just in India, in various places, that having users isn't equal to having consumers, right? So where do you produce value? This is not an ecosystem where everybody could take part in the venture capital speculative bubbles and practices and so on. That's still very much a niche zone. So where else can you produce value? And development is a great legitimizing force for value production. This is not just in India. This is the history of many different, most of the world when it comes to technology-enabled development, right? Whether it is the Gates Foundation or whether it is your Amazon or our very own Jio, right? So the larger, what should I say, stable sites of power and value production both have been destabilized, right? This is a very broad claim. I can go on unpacking it, but I think we can both agree that the dominant sites where power and value were being produced have been unsettled. So some of these collaborations are emerging from that zone. But what the book tries to do is try to map how data enables that kind of imagination and practices around it to flow.
So the last few chapters of the book are ethnographies, and they constitute ethnographic accounts of data and analytics that map the everyday aspects of data in India, right? And I think the important aspect here is that it shows that, you know, that data meshes with older modes of data collection and use, right? I think these everyday accounts really allow us to also understand how power shifts between the new and the older modes of tech mediation. That goes to your earlier point of relationality, right? And I thought that kind of really brought that out. So why was it important to add those accounts to the volume?
This volume emerged from a realization of 2 years of fieldwork in Delhi, Bangalore, in different government and private and community-led data analytics settings, where one realized that the difference in the discourse and on the ground practices is immense. And what one could do as like as an individual scholar was just to critique that difference but the project and being part of a interdisciplinary institute in Delhi allowed us to collect, assemble different group of people from journalists, scholars, ethnographers, historians, data scientists, entrepreneurs, and then see how we can open it up. So this tension between the sort of ideal, the imagined seamless digital versus the intermedial and fragmented experience of data on ground, of digital infrastructures on ground, that is something that runs through the book. But in the last section, as you rightly pointed out, the ethnographies bring it into a very sharp focus per se, because there you can follow specific set of practitioners, whether it is the Uber driver or your public health survey data collector or a government bureaucrat navigating between WhatsApp and Excel sheets and PDFs. And you see how at the broadest level, you see how these temporal imaginaries of leapfrogging into data futures or digital futures are spatialized and localized and reassembled on the ground, right? And there is no one digital future. WhatsApp is also digital, Excel sheet is also digital, PDF is also digital. So then let's talk about how at the local level, the three get crisscrossed with sandwiches of paper in between, as it were, right? So that complicates the picture, and that really is not just India. That is most of the global South, where these practices intersect with older infrastructure in ways that is not just one linear old plus one linear new, but a totally transformed old and new. Yeah.
Did you consider unpacking the transnational aspects of data in India? I mean, now that you have not just big tech firms, but also different kinds of foundations and donors like Omidyar or Mozilla, for example, that are looking to affect the discourse around and the politics around data. And I think India is also looking to export some of these APIs abroad through the support of these entities, right? How do you unpack their role?
Is a question, and that is something that is not directly addressed in the volume, but it gives us some bits onto where to look for of how these organizations are entering into places where they otherwise weren't before, or were there in different capacities, now have assumed new kinds of role. If we look at, for example, histories of open source software, that was always part of a global network where Mozilla was involved in a different capacity and so on. But now with this bundling of the worlds of tech advocacy, governance, and development, as well as these contracts between technology firms and governments, right? What used to be something very limited to specific government projects is now just a perennial thing, right? So there's a lot of business that is, the state is a big customer, of, as it were, of these large technology vendors in a way. And as you rightly pointed out, the state is also exporting a lot of these technologies around Aadhaar and APIs to other countries. So that both way the traffic has increased, right? And to map it would require a different kind of effort, but something that would take into account what many of the authors are pointing out about what's going on the ground, and then follow it in different sites to see that if, for example, M-Pesa is working in a certain complicated way in Kenya, and your fintech payments are working in a certain complicated way in Bangalore, where and how do these practices enable or mobilize imaginaries and discourses of leapfrogging into paperless or cashless future, because that is neither happening there or here, but somewhere in between, there are imaginaries and discourses that are using them as examples, right? And other sites to shift our priorities of governance, to shift our conditions of speculative value production, economic value production, labor, and so on. So that investigation is key to unpack whatever is being exported or imported in terms of practices or technologies. How is it being locally worked upon on the ground? Yeah.
I don't want to ask you what your favorite chapter is, because that's kind of unfair. So maybe I'll ask, what chapter surprised you the most?
Well, that's a difficult one. The process of assembling it also took a while, and there were some who couldn't finally make it. And that's really difficult, but
Or maybe what chapter alarmed you the most?
I mean, I learned a lot through all of them, through all the presenters in the workshop, and people who had applied, and people who I was in touch with at a later point as well. For me, having done a couple of years of research in this field and then reading this, there are certain chapters that really break down very narrow debates that have gotten rather narrow in what is in the US Academy now, critical data studies, or how histories in media will look at data in one way, and historians of science and technology studies will look at it one way. So that way, if you look at Carl Mendonca's essay, who's a cinema studies scholar, and he's really opening a new space for understanding data practices of that of cinema and advertising, Blaze Advertising Company in 1980s in Bombay. And also Shivakumar Arumugam, who's an anthropologist by training and is opening the world of history of science to see that in Duckworth Lewis, cricket. So this is these sites open up different vantage points to understand how our lives and lives of data intersect and make each other. Otherwise, it is the standard Silicon Valley to Nandan Nilekani discourse that we are all too familiar with and are saturated by. Yeah.
Right. So maybe an unfair question to you, a kind of large one. What is India's data future? Will it be empowering and inclusive, or coercive and dystopian, or all of it simultaneously?
And the present certainly points towards the latter, right? And one of the things to understand is that these debates are staged as if the national polity is something that is external to them, right? Which is absolutely not the case. So we cannot go on talking about the nuances of X kind of regulation or Y kind of regulation without taking into account the very nature of power and democracy that has shifted in recent years, right? And it is all the more important to take that into account if we have to envision it differently. Because we have to take the context into account that how can we decentralize or interrupt this accumulation model that we are seeing, whether it is the big tech in the US or it's people who are inspired from it are trying to replicate it at different levels in India with big, large tech conglomerates penetrating deeper into smaller towns and rural markets and so on, right? So to challenge that that rather dystopian big tech, big state driven future, we have to connect debates on data with ongoing, urgent, critical debates in democracy.
And finally, what's your dissertation about?
Right. So the dissertation has taken a slightly different turn. I am looking at computational cultures at the intersections of the state and technology startups, and particularly in tier two and tier three cities. So what you mentioned about India's data futures or digital futures, I'm trying to look at how those futures are spatialized and reimagined in places that are not global hubs of IT business like Bangalore, but a place like Jaipur, which is not too small, but not the place that you would think of immediately when you think of India's digital future. But yet, certain digital futures are being made there. And how do we de-territorialize this imaginary of the future is something that I'm concerned with right now.
Well, that sounds like a really good book that'll come out in the next few years, which we can hopefully read and talk about then. Thank you so much, Sandeep.
Thank you so much, Karthik. I really appreciate it.
And that was Sandeep Murtia, PhD candidate, NYU, on his recent edited volume, Lives of Data, published by the Institute of Network Cultures in late 2020. I'm Karthik Nachipan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.